This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
In this week's prime ministerial announcements over net zero, commentators began to discern some of the battle lines for an election that must be held within the next 16 months. But whatever the promises, how much real latitude will the UK's economic and financial position for the term of any new government give to the party which wins that election? Or, to put it crudely, is there any money? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Our first job is to understand the constraints that will face any government after the next election. The time frame we've chosen is from the beginning of 2025 onwards. And to help us, I have with me Paul Johnson, Director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Paul Johnson, things change all the time, obviously, but in broad terms, what do we currently know about the projected state of public finances for, say, 2025 and the 5 years after that?
Borrowing over the last few years has been incredibly high as we come out of the pandemic. Levels of borrowing are actually forecast to go down to really relatively modest levels over the next 4 or 5 years. But there's a big problem, nevertheless. And that problem is that the overall level of our national debt, so not the amount that we borrow each year, but the accumulated debt, is barely set to fall over that period. It's stuck around 100% of national income, which is the highest it's been since the early 1960s. And we know that both the main parties are committed to getting that level down into the medium term. And that, unfortunately, is really hard at the moment. It's hard for several reasons. One is that we're paying an awful lot of debt interest payments, more than we have in generations. One, that we're already increasing taxes, and that's not enough to offset this increased debt. And the third issue is that this is happening despite the fact that the plans for spending set out in the budget are really very tight.
Paul, just for the sake of listeners, how confident can we be about the future forecasts?
In precise terms, we can't have any confidence at all in forecasts. Forecasts are inevitably inaccurate, both because we don't know what's going to happen to the economy, but also, of course, we don't know what the government of the day is going to do. But I think we can be pretty confident, I'm afraid, that the overall picture is rather gloomy. It would take something pretty remarkable to dig us out of the hole that we're currently in with the public finances, a remarkable surge in growth or a remarkable surge in tax revenues. And without that, I can say, I think really quite confidently, that unless there are policies to increase taxes, then we're going to have a very tough time on the spending side going forward.
Well, let's talk about tax receipts and the option of increasing the amount we tax people.
Yeah, I mean, we are actually living through a pretty remarkable period in terms of taxation. Taxes rising a lot over the period of this Parliament. Through a lot of my life, and I'm in my 50s now, tax revenue as a fraction of national income has hovered around the 32 to 34% level. It's gone up and down in recessions and booms. But actually, over this period, it's going up to 36 or 37% of national income. That's quite a lot. That's between 70 and £100 billion increase in the amount of tax coming out of the economy. And my guess is that that's never, or at least not in the foreseeable future, going to come back down to where it's been for the last 50 years or so. So we're already getting to a point where tax is higher than it's essentially ever been before in this country. And yet, because of low growth, high interest payments, costs of the health service, and so on, that still doesn't seem to be enough to pay for all of the things that we want to spend it on. Now, it is possible to increase tax more than that. Most other Western European countries do have significantly higher levels of tax take than we do, but it will be to increase it from a very high base rather than increasing it from the sort of average that we've had for quite a long time.
Could you just take us through what kind of levels of tax these other countries do pay, so that we've got some kind of clear comparator?
Well, if you look at France, the Scandinavian countries and so on, significantly more than here, maybe as much as 10 percentage points of national income. So in terms of thinking about the UK economy, that's maybe £250 billion more in tax than we pay. I mean, it is really quite a substantial amount additional can be taken from a successful economy, and that economy can still be successful. A lot of that tax comes from their social insurance contribution system. They have more generous pensions, more generous benefits for people who are out of work, for example, paid through their equivalent of national insurance contributions. Some of the tax comes from the fact they tend to have broader VAT bases. In other words, they charge VAT on things like food, which we don't. Where it doesn't come from, much higher taxes on the rich, or much higher taxes on big corporations and companies. Actually, we, particularly with the recent increases, have probably a higher tax take from companies than most of those countries which actually have higher tax takes overall.
That's very interesting. So it's not true to say that actually our tax take is lower because we let the rich off paying more.
No, it's not. No. And again, this might be hard to hear, but actually our tax take is lower on the whole because we are taxing people on average and somewhat above average earnings rather less than is the case in somewhere like France, for example.
This may surprise people when they look back on the period of what we now call the period of austerity, when it was believed that we had significantly reduced public spending in big areas, and consequently that should have created more latitude for investment later on.
Yeah, and we're in a horrible bind, as it were. We did go through this very dramatic period of austerity with very big cuts in some areas of government spending. And the biggest cuts came in some of those areas which are actually least visible: social care, local government, justice, prisons and so on, all of which areas are really struggling at the moment. But that unfortunately has been accompanied in this country, as it actually has been in many other countries, with very low levels of growth and with increased spending, dramatically increased spending, on things like health, partly because of an ageing population, partly because of increased demand, partly because of increased costs. And so we're spending more on some areas of public services, less on others. But that lack of growth and these high interest payments mean that even with that, after that period of austerity, we're still struggling to pay for the public services that people seem to demand.
Let's look at some examples of things which we either are or are not committed to, which may fall into these categories. The NHS long-term workforce plan, which was announced, and it seems to require significant investment. As far as you know, do we know where the money for that is coming from, whether we have the money to do it?
Yeah, the NHS workforce plan is a remarkable thing, actually. I mean, it is a good thing that we have finally got one, and it's extraordinary that we haven't had one before. It really is, given the huge numbers of people who work for the NHS and how difficult it is to make sure we have the right number of doctors and nurses and other professions allied to medicine. But the plan is very, very ambitious. It's talking about an additional 900,000 people working in the NHS by the middle of the next decade. That would actually take it to about one person in 11 in employment in the whole country working in the health service, which is an extraordinary statistic. That would increase health spending just by itself by 2 or 3% in real terms every year over the next 12 or 13 years. And in today's terms, as a fraction of national income, we're talking about an additional £50 billion or so just on that bit of the health service. Now, that's one of the reasons why, in my view, I think we are likely to see taxes rise even further than where we have them at the moment, because to pay for that by cutting other elements of public spending, particularly given the decade of austerity we've been through, just looks very difficult unless there is a very big change in public opinion or a very big change in what governments are willing to do in terms of cutting spending. So if we are to fund that, just that NHS workforce plan, that itself, I think, will drive policies over the next decade towards more tax to pay for it, as I say, unless we really can find other areas of big spending cuts.
Now, Paul, just in recent days, we've had a controversy about an area that fits absolutely, or it seems to, into this kind of nexus of growth, investment, expenditure, which is the net zero plans. What can you say about what net zero was likely to be costing, the move towards net zero was likely to be costing, and what benefit we were likely to be getting from it in that time period we're talking about, which is 2025 to 2030?
Well, we're looking at, over the whole period through to 2050, which is the net zero plan, we're looking at costs of investment of into the trillions, well over £1,000 billion. Mostly from the public sector, because this obviously involves private companies investing in battery technology and so on. But it would involve significant tens of billions over the period of the next parliament to make sure that we continue to decarbonise electricity, that we move to the charging network we need for cars, and most difficult and most expensive of all, over a period, decarbonising our houses, in other words, moving away from gas boilers. So this is a significant amount of money. It's not, in a sense, in an economy which is more than £2 trillion big. If this is an extra 20 or 30 or 40 billion pounds of investment every year, that's manageable. But it is substantial. And the Prime Minister, in a sense, is right to point out that this is a big, expensive, disruptive, difficult set of things that need to be done. But if we're to deal with climate change, they're things that have to be done.
Can I just ask you this finally, Paul? It's hard to know sometimes whether or not governments, oppositions are setting their economic plans and their spending plans in tune with the electors, with the voters in mind, or with the markets in mind. Can you take us through that one?
Well, in a sense, they always have to do this with the markets in mind to some extent. I mean, if you're going to borrow a lot, someone has to buy that debt. And that someone is the pension funds and the investors and actually increasingly foreign investors. And we saw a year ago what happened when a series of things happened, when this Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng announced very big unfunded tax cuts. They didn't use the Office of Budget Responsibility. They said there was going to be more coming down the line. They sacked the permanent secretary of the Treasury. But all of those things together, and they suddenly, we suddenly found it really actually quite difficult to raise that money from the markets, which is what pushed interest rates up very quickly at that period. You cannot ignore the markets. And if you do, then you're in danger of running into problems. You also, of course, can't ignore the electorate. And we've seen swings in fiscal policy over time as the electorate has changed its view about how much they're willing to pay in tax on how much is required in spending. So if you look back at the 2015 election, for example, and it's quite hard to remember in some ways, the Conservatives won unexpectedly by promising big cuts in Social Security spending and promising yet more austerity. And that, in a sense, was their political view about what would fly with the electorate. I think what will fly with the electorate today might be something rather different. But the difficulty to both parties at the moment is to sort of go back to what we've been saying all through this, we've got this horrible nexus where if they're going to offer what it seems the public now wants in terms of more spending on health and education and so on, the only way you can do that, as far as I can see, unless we get very lucky, is actually to look at higher levels of tax from what's already a high tax base. And I don't honestly think that either of them are really levelling with us about the very difficult choices that that's going to imply over the next few years.
Paul Johnson. And just before we move on to how the parties are shaping up to face that challenge, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about crumbling concrete, the one about HS2, and the one about whether we can meet the net zero challenge. Now we'll pick up where we left off with Paul Johnson and look at how the big two UK parties seem to be shaping up to meet a daunting challenge. Joining me in the briefing room are Meryn Khan, economics editor of The Times, and Torsten Bell, chief executive of the Resolution Foundation. Torsten Bell, how are you perceiving that the Conservatives are preparing for the next election in terms of economic policy?
Well, the big picture is they are regretting having had or having had to put up taxes very significantly already over recent years, partly for political reasons. The punters don't tend to like it. And then also for ideological reasons, which is large parts of the Conservative Party want to argue that taxes should be coming down, but they've had a Conservative government very significantly raising taxes. So I think that is the backdrop to their political considerations then for how do they manage going into an election where they would rather talk about taxes going down rather than up. But the underlying causes of those tax rises, debt interest payments rising, public service pressures being very significant, not having gone away.
Merine, how influenced do you think they are by the experience of a year ago and the Liz Truss, Kwasi Kwarteng, what would we call it? Catastrophe?
That's polite. I think they're very influenced by it, mainly because of the fact that Liz Truss is still around. She still dominates political discourse. Every time she decides to do a speech, the media pays attention. So the shadow of Liz Truss may have been wiped from the gilt market. So we see a little spike that happened this time last year, and we've sort of gone back to a relatively normal situation. But because she plays this sort of outsized role, I think, in the public discourse, and the fact that she's so unashamed about what happened and still lies blame for the international bureaucracy, the Treasury orthodoxies, the anti-growth coalition, which is basically her pointing fingers at the current Chancellor and the Prime Minister, mean that it's hard to ignore Liz Truss as a figure. The Tory party don't seem to have forgotten her, neither do the media, and probably voters neither. So in some senses, we're still living in the shadow of the Liz Truss moment. And there seems to be this kind of a sense in which she might reemerge in this election campaign, which is exactly what the Prime Minister and the government don't want.
This week we had Rishi Sunak's announcements on net zero. Did you see that principally as driven by a need to cut the cost of net zero to the Treasury and give it more headroom, or primarily as an attempt to try and say to the voters, we're cutting the cost directly to you of net zero policy?
You can look at it just as a bean counting exercise. We will lose fuel duty. That could be tens of billions of pounds when people move to electric vehicles. There will be short-term costs imposed on households if they have to move towards different types of, installing different types of boilers. But given that the Prime Minister's message was much more about trying to be pragmatic, I think the difficulty is that it's seen as an ideological move and also an overtly political move, because I think the party of government think that they've got Labour a little bit snookered now, because they're telling people, we don't want you to pay the cost of a green transition, which is happening too quickly and perhaps you didn't consent to it. So is the response from Labour going to be, well, actually, we're going to stick to the targets. And not only that, but we will try and tax carbon in indirect or direct ways, that we will embark on a green transition. And then in the public consciousness, that is attached to costs and not really benefits. So it will be interesting to see whether this week's sort of shift actually crystallizes the different approaches of the two parties to the public finances, with climate as sort of the proxy for a different sort of philosophical divide between them.
Torsten, that's a very interesting set of observations about potential economic strategy, which, to put it in another way, seems to suggest the Conservatives know they can't promise too much themselves in terms of what they can actually do. But the objective is to open up a gap between them and what they say Labour will cost the ordinary voter.
Yeah, I mean, that is something that's quite unusual about British politics, that exact way of thinking is very, very dominant in UK election campaigns, has been for some time. It's not that like that in most European countries, and it's not like that in the United States. And I think the underpinning drivers of that are that the British fiscal state, the fiscal forecast, the actual economic plans for the public finances, those are very centralised in the UK, i.e. at a national level, but also that the government controls the legislature in a way you don't see in the United States. So government plans for the public finances are treated as if they're actually going to happen, whereas they're just treated as forecasts in lots of other countries, and then we'll see what happens when the world turns up. And so that means that government has the power to basically decide what the background set of forecasts are for the coming election. They can decide how much fiscal headroom there is, for example, left against those forecasts, and they can use that to try to shape the economic political debate ahead of an election. And that is unusual. It's probably deeply unhelpful generally, because it means we end up having these hilarious conversations about whether a small difference on public spending and tax choices represents really big changes, and it actually does box in actual decisions. So, for example, why has the government penciled in some really big cuts to public investment levels over the next few years? It's not because the Chancellor thinks lower investment is actually what the country needs. It's because he wants to make sure that he has got some space for tax cuts, that he doesn't have to make any more further cuts to day-to-day public spending, but also so Labour doesn't have headroom itself.
Mary, let's turn to Labour. And what Torsten's just said suggests a reason why it is that Labour might be very, very reluctant to give any clear economic plans before the immediate run-up to an election.
Yes, and there's other uncomfortable things that Labour don't want to shed too much of a light on, including what Torsten's just mentioned, which is the fact that we're going to have real-time public spending cuts, because that is the inheritance that they will may take on if indeed they are the party of government. So there's almost like an inbuilt disadvantage to throwing too much light on the terrible state of the public finances. Labour have said some stuff. One of them is that they want a £28 billion a year green investment plan. That's a lot of money. We know the Tories have sort of penciled in around £8 billion a year. So let's say Labour want to add £20 billion on top. They say that's for green investment, just dedicated to creating an industrial policy around the green supply chain. But given the overall state of public spending in the UK, which has been declining for decades, is below the OECD average, that spending pot is probably going to go on all types of spending and not just green spending, because that's part of the problem that Labour will inherit. Not just that we're falling behind rival countries on building green supply chains, but we're just falling behind on capital investment, full stop.
We heard Paul Johnson say that, in his opinion, if you were going to do anything in addition to what you're doing already, you'll have to raise taxes to do it. Firstly, do you agree with that broadly? And secondly, do you think Labour agrees with that secretly but won't say it?
On the first point, yes. I think it's just inevitable, given the size of the state and the demands that have been made on the state, as Paul mentions, that we need to find a tax system which is suited for decades into the future of an ageing population. Another policy area is defence, where the UK government has radically changed its ambitions, given in light of geopolitical events. Defence spending was one of the massive areas which has been structurally declining for decades, and we basically used that money to pump it into the NHS. But now we need to find that money again. So there is a bigger conversation about what a modern tax system looks like. And also, the UK has historically been between Europe and the US in many ways. And on tax, we sort of attached to a more Anglo-Saxon, American-style way of thinking we're a low-tax country. But the public seem to be wanting or demanding a sort of social democratic European style of public services. And at some point, that tension has always sort of existed and the UK has muddled through. But it seems that we have to sort of confront that trade-off and decide what kind of country we want to be. And if we want to geographically align a bit more with how European social democracies work, then we have to have a tax system that is fit for purpose. And if that's not the case, then we do really move to an American way of thinking. But that, I don't think that's in tune with public mood right now.
Torsten, this gives Labour what it seems to me is an absolutely central problem, which is, according to Paul Johnson, actually, we don't have particularly low taxes for the wealthier people. And if you're talking about increasing taxation in any significant way in order to fund things that people want, that's really everybody's taxes that needs to go up. I mean, do you think the Labour is within any kind of reach of actually saying that?
The real question about whether taxes will go up significantly in the shorter term in the years ahead, I think, is much more uncertain. And that is to do with what is the future path of interest rates globally. This is rather than just in the UK, and whether, you know, a new government basically gets lucky on having a falling debt interest bill after the peak we're seeing right now. And that means that there is less immediate pressure and more headroom for rescuing public services without tax rises. So I think everyone should sound a little bit less certain than they do, unless you're talking about the medium term, in which I think case I agree that the direction of travel in the medium term is for taxes to be higher rather than lower. In terms of where that money comes from, again, I disagree slightly in the confidence that it definitely is taxes on everybody. I mean, generally, countries that spend more as a share of GDP than we do have higher taxes on everyday working people. So they're not just about the super rich. But I think that can be heard as underestimating the changes we can make to improve the quality of our taxes, not just the quantity. And some of those could lead to significant amounts of money being raised. It's less actually about raising taxes on all rich people. Some rich people, particularly employees who are high earning, do pay reasonably high taxes in the UK. But there are some people, the self-employed, those who are able to set themselves up as businesses, those who make their money through capital gains in the UK, where they do not pay enough tax and significant sums could be raised. So actually what we're looking at is fairness amongst the rich rather than fairness between the rich and everyone else.
So those might be things, Meereen, if because you were nodding along to some of that, those might be things that you might anticipate Labour saying in the approach to an election, or do you think it won't?
It's interesting that everything we've heard from Rachel Reeves so far has been trying to reassure people that Labour is not going to, for example, impose new wealth taxes. That's something that the opposition has already said, perhaps a little bit unprompted. I'm not sure who was asking them, but they definitely told us that it wasn't in their plans. Then we think about the green transition, which imposes costs, but it also is it there is a taxation opportunity. If we want to incentivize companies and industry to move towards less carbon intensive activity.
You mean by taxing polluting behavior?
Yes.
Well, that's very interesting. Torsten, one of the things which often gets said at this point, of course, is that we could actually borrow more if we chose to. We've talked with Paul Johnson about why that actually might be more constrained than that proposition suggests. But then people will point to America and say, look at Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act. He didn't seem to be too worried about building up debt. Why can't we do that?
Well, America, for a whole host of reasons, is less worried about the level of debt than a much smaller, more open economy like the UK. Lots of people are going to hold dollars and hold US government debt for a whole host of reasons. And remember also, you know, we talk about Biden's Inflation Reduction Act and the CHIPS Act, but both of these passed with bipartisan support. So the politics of that are very different to a country, as I say, with a very centralized tax and spending situation where the government and the opposition will row about what are for us going to be basically pretty small differences in the actual level of tax and spending in election campaigns. If you go back to 2010, remember, a lot of the row about the pace of austerity or deficit reduction was actually about very small amounts. I think George Osborne was proposing £6 billion of cuts in the first year of a new Conservative government back in 2010. So the situations are very different, and the election in the UK pays much more attention to these small differences in fiscal policy than you ever see in US politics.
Meereen, that almost kind of suggests that actually it doesn't really make much difference in the economic front who wins, and that an awful lot of sound and fury will be going on to try and create differences between the two parties to suggest to voters that there's a point in making a choice.
This is, as Torsten said, quite a uniquely British thing, this sort of hyperfixation on fiscal events, which we have two a year. I mean, if anyone's paying attention, I think the French government just passed their budget. In the Netherlands, they don't even have a government and they've presented a budget plan. You know, in the UK, there's a lot of outsized attention on these fiscal events and budgets and chancellors standing and taking photo opportunities with their, you know, red boxes. So it's true that we're perhaps missing the point. And maybe just on the point about borrowing, there's a sort of received wisdom that foreign investors, the debt markets, will look at your fiscal plans. And if you're going to borrow a lot of money to do good stuff with it, to build out the productive capacity of the economy, to ensure longer term prosperity, to raise productivity, then the markets will sort of give you a bit of a free pass, which is what Liz Truss didn't really do. Now, that's not a logic that's really ever been tested in the UK, let alone tested to destruction. So it'd be interesting if they do manage to get into power, whether Labour will start bringing this discourse in, saying, actually, we are borrowing, but because we're going to spend the money on the right stuff.
Meereen Khan there with Torsten Bell. Thanks to them and to Paul Johnson. My conclusion, the country faces hard choices, and the extra hard choice that the politicians face is whether to be upfront about just how difficult things are. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Claire Bowes and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was mixed by Rod Farker. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hear brand new satire on the Friday Night Comedy Podcast from BBC Radio 4 with 6 summer specials.
Hello, I'm Dom Jolly, and I'm going to be bringing you a mashup of interviews, features, prank calls in Dom Jolly Breaks the News. Oh, sorry, was that my fault?
6 one-off topical comedies.
I'm Catherine Bohart, and in TLDR, I'll be digging deep into one of the week's big stories.
Whew. 6 different presenters, including Rhys James, Ria Lina, Andrew Hunter-Murray,
and starting with me, Rachel Paris, and my interview show, The Newsmakers.
Hear brand new satire on the Friday Night Comedy Podcast with 6 summer specials. If you're in the UK, listen to the latest episode now on BBC Sounds before anywhere else.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life,
and all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.